looking back at some of the other honors, there's the We Met Caddy Scholarship Fund. You must be very proud of that.
I'm very proud of that. That caddy fund was organized in 1949, and it has been a source of great satisfaction to me.
There's no story that could ever be told that is richer or sweeter than the story of Francis and Eddie.
And may your lives be full of birdies and eagles.
Hello and welcome to Legacy, the We Met Fun podcast. We're your hosts, Alistair Ingram and Colin McGuire. If you'd like to go back and listen to any of our prior conversations on the Legacy podcast, you can check out our website at wemet.org. As the fund celebrates its 75th anniversary, the We Met community has helped award $50 million in need-based college scholarships to more than 6,600 deserving young men and women since 1949. Proving that one episode just wasn't enough to do him justice, we're joined for the second time on the Legacy podcast by trustee Dick Connolly. There is no one who has been more supportive, more passionate, and more dedicated to the Francis We Met Scholarship Fund than him. Dick started caddying as an 8-year-old at Woburn Country Club and earned a We Met scholarship to attend Holy Cross, where he captained the golf team before beginning a remarkable professional career. He spent nearly 60 years in the financial services industry, becoming one of the most successful and respected advisors in the country. Exactly a week after this year's We Met banquet in late March, Dick officially retired as managing partner of the Connolly Group at Morgan Stanley. One of his clients was Arnold Palmer, who became a dear friend and a passionate supporter of the We Met Fund. Dick was instrumental in expanding the annual banquet in 1997, during which Palmer was the first recipient of the We Met Award for lifelong contributions to golf. Dick and his wife of 43 years, Anne Marie, are the largest benefactors in the history of the fund, and the Connollys have made a lifetime commitment to countless other charitable causes locally, nationally, and abroad. Dick's philanthropic efforts are perhaps only topped by his modesty and his storytelling. And with that, we hope you enjoy our second conversation with Dick Connolly.
All right. Well, Dick, it's welcome back, which we have not said before. First guest to be on a second episode. It's great to start back up season two and bring back Dick Connolly for this. So thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Alistair and I were just thinking about how to start with the second episode with you. As you know, we start each episode with a question about early memories of golf. And on our first episode, you talked about getting into caddying and because Ernie Doherty and all your uncles were getting over to Woburn Country Club. So I thought this episode, maybe Dick, start off, what are some of your early golf memories with your wife, Anne Marie, or your three boys as they started out in golf? I have a feeling it started off with less about grip and more about enjoying time together out in the golf course and carrying themselves, things like that. But what were your first memories of Anne Marie and the boys on the golf course?
Yeah, first of all, when I first met Anne Marie, she had no interest whatsoever in golf. She was a tennis player. And then when we had the three boys, she kind of stayed with tennis because obviously tennis took a lot less time than golf. But as the kids grew older, she got involved in golf and now was addicted to the game and actually has become pretty good. The three boys, all three of them caddied at Concord Country Club. So that was a good experience for them. And of course, growing up, I would take them out with me and just fooling around, having some fun, play 5 or 6 holes, sometimes 2 or 3 holes or whatever. But they were more involved themselves in the other sports. All three of the boys were pretty good athletes, and they all played 3 sports through high school. So golf never really got to be a big deal to them until they got a little older. They played, and they were decent, but they were more interested in the other sports. Now they all play golf. Now they all belong to a club and really love the game. And one of the great things that they enjoyed was meeting Arnold Palmer, who used to stay at our house all the time, and it was a big deal for the kids. So that obviously piqued their interest a little more too, as well.
You bet. It's a common theme, right? We all wish we started earlier than we did or play golf forever. Can't necessarily play football forever.
I didn't force them into anything. I let them play the sports they wanted to play. And just as it turned out, it was more baseball, hockey, football, lacrosse. Those are the sports they played growing up, and they continued to play them when they were in college. All three played a sport in college, which was great.
Emory's certainly making up for lost time with being on golf committees, We Met committees, and getting her rounds in.
Yeah, she loves the game, and she's actually been on the board now at Catansett for a number of years, and she's become very involved with We Met activities at other clubs as well. So,
Dick, golf has really never been more popular, especially since COVID, really more than it ever has. Even if you don't get out and play as much as you did maybe 20, 30 years ago, what's the reason why you're still so into the game, following it, watching it, whether it's from the local mass amateur level or professional majors? Why has golf been so special to you all these years, even if you don't quite get out on the course as much?
Ed, because back to my days as a caddy, I've said many times, and the single best experience I've ever had my years as a caddy because of the examples that were set by the people that I caddied for. So the love of golf started as a young boy. I started caddying at 8 years old. Then I became a pretty good junior player and obviously got the We Met scholarship, which is a big help when I was going to Holy Cross College and played a lot of competitive golf all through college. So that obviously is part of my DNA. And I've just loved the game. And my hero as a young boy growing up was Arnold Palmer. To think that I became his financial advisor, and I used to talk to Arnold at least two or three times a week, sometimes every day. So we became extremely close. And that obviously kept me as much involved as ever. And the people I met through Arnold in golf that really kept my interest going. And golf, to me, is a special game because you show your worst and your best when you're in the golf course. And I saw that as a caddy. And it's the same thing if you're out there playing with business associates or with friends, and you don't conduct yourself the way they expect you to, it's a major negative, throwing a club or using bad language or whatever. And the amount of charitable dollars that golf has helped to raise is like no other sport. It's mind-boggling. So my love of golf has continued. I still love the game as much as I ever did. I watch golf all the time on TV, and it's been addictive as far as I'm concerned from the time I was a young man.
Dick, I hear you talk about enjoying watching golf. It's always fun to catch up with you a day or two after a major, or even with, say, the Mass Am Championship just ending. I've been in the room. I've heard you talk about some stories. It's also an awful lot about the people, right? I mean, the people that you've had a chance to get to know or learn about, or even from afar on television, but also some people in the local game that you've had a chance to interact with and get to know through Mass Golf or the We Met Memorial Tournament, whatever it may be. You've met some pretty great people.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No question. It's been a big, big part of my life. The people that I met became friends, and absolutely had a big part of my business life through golf. When I was building a business, I entertained a lot of people on the golf course, and that worked out fine. But more importantly, the people that I met, in almost in every case, they were real fine people. So that is absolutely true, Colin.
And what's incredible these days, Dick, I'm sure with the amount of golf that you watch, the youth of the game right now is on full display. I mean, you have teenagers, literally, who are making an impact right now on the professional tours at each level. You had a 15-year-old who just made the top 25 on the Korn Ferry Tour, Miles Russell. I mean, it's amazing what young players in the game are doing right now before they're even supposedly hit their primes.
Well, of course, instruction is so good now for the young kids, and there's so many opportunities to play in tournaments from the time they're 7, 8, 9 years old, all growing up, playing high school, playing college. The opportunities to play and compete are mind-boggling. And of course, we have thousands of real good players now because of the way the system has worked out. You know, I remember a young man that I really got to like and thought did a great job as far as representing the game was Jordan Spieth, and he still is. When he burst in the scene, he won 3 majors in a short period of time. But more importantly, he's a quality young man. What's going on now with Scottie Scheffler and the quarter girl, it's hard to believe. And obviously, they're great, great players. She just wins 5 in a row. He wins 4 out of 5, and the other one he finished 2nd in. If you remember, he missed a 5-foot putt to go into a playoff. Scheffler, in my opinion, is so good. Unless he doesn't putt well, they can't beat him. That's how good he is from tee to green. If he doesn't putt well, they have a chance. But if he putts well, the rest of his game is so good. And beyond that, what I really like is the way they conduct themselves. And he always is telling people that, like right now, he's expecting a new baby, And he said, when the baby comes, golf will be number four on his list of priorities. I'd love to hear someone talking that way. That's the way we're supposed to be. And of course, a lot of the people that are involved in athletics or just in general don't do the stuff that we'd like to be able to use them as examples for our own kids. And Nellie Corder is a very special, and she conducts herself very well also. And to hear Julie Inkster and Judy Rankin talk about her when we had some private conversations before the banquet, they recognize what a great talent she is.
Dick, do you think you'll be coming out to the FM Global Championship Labor Day to see her in person?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. That women's tour now is, talk about the talent that's out there. It's unbelievable. And the other kid that just popped on the scene, he's only a year out of college, is Oberg. And I mean, what a magnificent golf swing he's got, and what a great, great player. Nellie Corder's swing is one of the finest swings that I've ever seen, along with the Oberg kid. Magnificent golf swings, and I think they're both going to be great champions for a long time. But to have those kind of swings, and a lot of that, I don't think you can teach a swing that good. You can teach fundamentals, but both of their swings are so natural, it's hard to believe. And how about his personality? I was saying to Colin earlier, he double bogeyed the 11th hole on the last day, and he's walking up to the 12th tee at Augusta, and he's smiling at the fans. Now, that's what you call an actual personality, which is going to hold him in good stead for many years to come. The ultimate, as far as I'm concerned, in charisma was Arnold, and the fans loved him because of that. He interacted with the fans all the time.
That move at Augusta probably reminded you of Arnold, right?
It did remind me of Arnold. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Arnold knew it was because of the fans that golf flourished. And without the fans, that's not going to work that way. And of course, what's happened now, Alistair, you mentioned that COVID has brought millions more into the game of golf. And that's just obviously helping to grow as well. And it will develop more good players.
Yeah, those golf swings of Oberg or Nellie Corder, Dick, that's who you want to model a golf swing after.
That's right. That's right.
Speaking of Arnold Palmer, Dick, I mean, with so many stories that you even were able to tell us during the first season, and really anytime you can mention Arnold Palmer is spectacular. I actually have a quick anecdote with Arnold. From your neck of the woods, there used to be the senior PGA Tour event at Neshottoc every year, and I got to volunteer at that event a couple of times and was actually the standard bearer for his group for a whole 18-hole round, which this was probably 20, 25 years ago, and it still resonates with me today because the one thing I took out of that round was watching him interact with fans, and specifically young fans. I mean, every single time he would walk between a hole from green to tee, he was rubbing a little girl's head, he was smiling, he was high-fiving kids, and he must have been over 70 at the time. He wasn't going to win the event. He was just out there. It was probably 90 degrees, but I'm assuming that resonates with you, that that's just the kind of guy he was. And I think it's important that younger golfers today can emulate that, can realize that, hey, you're not just here to golf. You're here to be an ambassador for the game, and you can be a hero for these kids.
Well, when he played in that tournament, he used to stay with us. He stayed with us in Concord. So we'd stay here the whole week. And Tracy West, who ran that tournament, she had called me up a couple of months before Arnold was going to come. Now, as you guys know, they don't have to commit to the next tournament until the Friday before. Well, Tracy used to ask me all the time, would you see if Arnold will tell us he's going to come in advance? She said, yeah, that'll help the gate. And of course, Arnold would always do that. Tracy told me that was worth 25% more fans that they knew he was definitely coming and not wondering. And you're right, the way he conducted himself was mind-boggling. And of course, the more time I spent around him, the more I realized what a magnificent man he was and how he realized that it was because of golf that he became who he was. Like Arnold used to say himself, he said, look, they call me the king. I'm not any king. I'm an ambassador for golf, and hopefully I've done a good job. You just mentioned it, Alistair. He was interacting with the fans the whole way around. And you're right. He wasn't going to win the golf tournament, but the crowds were still there to see him. Every hole he walked, you said you're in a standard bearer. If you remember, every tee and every green, a standing ovation. That amazed me because to be that well-loved, it's unbelievable. I forget who it was, but someone said that no one's ever said a bad thing about Arnold Palmer. And that's so true. But he earned that. And the good thing, too, is an example, Arnold's two heroes were his mother and father. That's what you love to see as well.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because at those events, when I used to volunteer there, we'd show up in the morning. There were no assignments yet in terms of who you were paired with. You would actually draw golf balls. They would write numbers on golf balls, throw them in a bag. And then if you were a standard bearer, you would pick a ball out of a hat, out of a bag. And if you got number one, you had first pick. And there were far better players at that time on the senior tour. But I was lucky enough to select first. And I knew going in, if I got the first golf ball, it was going to be Arnold Palmer. There was no question about it. It wasn't about watching someone at that time win the tournament. It was about saying I could walk 18 holes with Arnie.
Yeah, Dick, Alistair and I got the ambassador Arnold Palmer, the legend Arnold Palmer. You were able to experience the heyday and the prime. In your mind, how does, say, a 35-year-old Arnold Palmer fit into today's game? Like, where would you see that going in that direction in this like hypothetical scenario I'm just thinking about as we talked about Scotty and Nelly Korda?
Well, first of all, when they compare eras, the great players, like, for example, Hogan today would be a great, great player. The great ones. Same thing with Arnold. He'd be one of the great, great players. There's no question about it. When they say that so-and-so is better than so-and-so, you go back to the days of Bobby Jones. If Bobby Jones were here today, he'd be one of the great players. That wouldn't have changed. The other thing that Arnold would continue to be doing is with that personality and that charisma, he'd be the most popular person in the game even now. No question about it. I think it was Sam Snead that once said that Arnold goes to bed with charisma and wakes up with more charisma in the morning. The wonderful thing about him was it was natural. You can't fake that. Either you have that much charisma or you don't. You can make yourself more personal and all that, but not to the degree that he did. And he was the same in the locker room. He was the same with the shoe shine guy as he was with anybody else. So what you saw was what you got, and it never changed. And I saw him when he was dead tired and still was being great to the fans and just a magnificent man. It was great to me and my family.
I was hoping you might be able to kind of retell that story. Can you share that story about Dave Marr, who's done our banquet as MC four or five times? His father was, I think, in the final group or second to last group with Arnold in the Masters, and kind of walk me through how that went down, and I think maybe 16 or 17 tee.
Yeah, Dave Marr was one of Arnold's best friends. And as you're right, his son has been one of our MCs and a nice guy. But David Marr was one of Arnold's closest friends. And in 1964 at the Masters, Dave Marr was paired with Arnold in the last round. And Arnold was leading by 8 shots. And Arnold says to David Marr, and Marr was tied with Jack Nicklaus. They were tied.
Well, they were tied for second behind Arnold?
And Nicklaus and Marr were tied for second. And Arnold was 8 shots in the lead. So Arnold said to David Marr, anything I can do to help you? And David Marr said, yeah, make 12.
He was still looking to win. Yeah. Maybe we kind of stay a little bit on the same topic, but thinking back in March, a few weeks back, the We Met Fund held its 25th annual banquet since it became our marquee kickoff in 97. Julie Inkster had that sellout crowd at the Encore. It was phenomenal. When, again, 97, your friend Arnold flew up and became our first honoree. So thinking about Arnold and friends that have come from that and his peers and contemporaries, what are some of your fondest memories looking back on the We Met annual banquet and Arnold and others as you think back on the 25 banquets that we've had, the honorees, the student speakers, and you know, even if it wasn't at the banquet, the people that we've honored?
Well, first of all, on the student speakers, every student speaker, thinking back, we've had, I thought they were all wonderful with their backgrounds and how they conducted themselves, and no different than our student speaker this year. The speakers that stand out in my mind, and of course, you're going back to 1997, obviously Arnold, President Bush, and Gary Player. I mention those three because of particular circumstance. Before the banquet that Arnold came to, he and I went downstairs at the hotel where it was being held that year, the Sheraton, and we sat at the bar and had a drink. And he asked me how many times I got physicals. And I said, about once a year. He said, well, make sure you do that, Dick, because it's important. Now, the reason he asked me that was the next day he was flying out to the Mayo Clinic to have prostate surgery. Now, you tell me anybody that knew they were going to have prostate surgery that would have come and still did the banquet the day before he was going out there. That's Arnold Palmer. President Bush, who was one of my heroes and one of the great Americans of all time, when you think of the record that he had the most impressive resume of anybody that was ever president, things he did in his life. And that was right in the middle of the pedophile stuff with the priest. And he walked up onto the stage, and Billy Foley, one of our former president's brother, was doing the invocation, Father Foley. First thing President Bush did was walk right over to Father Foley, and he said, "Father, it's going to get better." Now, he didn't have to do that. And Player, when he got up to speak after the student speaker spoke, he made a big deal out of how wonderful the young man was and so on and so forth. He walked over and sat, obviously, I always introduced the honoree. He walked over and sat down beside me and handed me a check for $100,000. Now, it's hard to forget those type of things, but it just shows you what golf can do as a sport as far as helping people, projecting the right way you're supposed to be. And let's face it, most of the people involved in golf have been pretty quality people. If I think back, I started caddying when I was 8 years old. I could count on one hand in all those years of anybody that I didn't think was just a nice man that went great to a young kid carrying a bag. That, to me, says it all about golf. You go back and you talk about people who we, Curtis Strange, Ben Crenshaw. Think about, too, many of the golfers, Ben Crenshaw is an example. Ben Crenshaw was a tremendous high school athlete, but golf's a sport that he chose to keep going, and he's a magnificent representative of the game of golf.
In the last episode, Dick, you had some great stories about those in golf who taught you, how they guided you in life, people like your mom and dad, your uncles, you mentioned Jim Powers, Ed Garrity, your friends from Woburn, Arnold Palmer. So we sit here today a month after, and we'll get to this, after your retirement. You joked last time as a young kid wanting to be a golfer as your career, and then you ended up getting a real job. Who were some of your professional mentors and the folks who guided or influenced you after you got into the, quote, real world, whether it be Ford Motor Company, maybe back at Payne Weber or elsewhere? Who are some of those people in the business world that you like to reference?
At Ford Motor Company, I was working out of the Teterboro office, Teterboro, New Jersey, which is right across from the airport. And that office was responsible for all of Southern Connecticut, all through New York, Long Island, whatever. And the regional manager was a fellow named Bill Murphy. And the training program was supposed to be 24 months. Then you would go out on the road and call on the dealers. And I kept pushing, saying I was ready to go out. Bear in mind, I had no business background whatsoever when I first went to work for Ford Motor Company. So I kept pushing to go out on the road. After about 19 months, which was obviously 5 months short of when the training was supposed to end, he called me in his office. He said, "Okay," he said, "Dick, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to put you out on the road. I'm going to make a prediction. You're either going to go straight up or straight down." But he gave me the opportunity, and I was very fortunate that it worked out well. But he took a chance. There's no question about it. You mentioned Jim Power. Jim Power was a tremendous example to me as a business guy. He built a little business, was very successful, and was one of the most generous people that I've ever known. Another individual, a guy named Gary Bean, who I met through business and became a client of mine, and just watching him operate, how honest he was, the way he serviced the client. He owned a forklift company, but the way he talked about servicing his clients, it was a great example and taught me the way I should be dealing with clients and servicing clients. And I'll just make one comment that my father mentioned to me growing up. He said, "Look, all I want to hear about my son is when he walks into a room or leaves a room, the people say, 'That's Dick Connolly, and he's a good guy, and you can trust him.'" He said, "Because without the trust, it doesn't matter." That came from my own father. I don't know if I ever mentioned that before, Colin, but that came from my own father. Let me give a quick story. You mentioned examples of mentors or whatever. When I was with Ford in the training program, you pretty much did whatever they wanted you to do. And part of our job then would we go over to the airport to pick up the executives coming into New York. Butler Aviation was the private part of LaGuardia. So this one day I'm driving over and I'm going to pick up Lee Iacocca, who at that time was the biggest man in the auto industry by far. He was the man that came out with the Mustang, so on and so forth. So I pull up in front of the terminal. He comes bouncing down the steps, and I'm petrified. Okay, come down the stairs. He opens the back door of the car and throws his coat and briefcase in the back seat. Gets in the front seat with me, passenger side. He looks at me and he says, "How you doing, buddy?" So I'm doing fine, Miss Iacocca. He said, "Well, let me stop right there." He said, "I'm going to tell you where you're from with that accent." But anyways, the ride from there back to the office, he was so nice to me. And I never forgot that. This was the biggest man in the automobile industry. And most of them, when you picked them up, they'd sit in the back seat. They wouldn't say a word. But he went out of his way to be nice to a young man. That helped me build my own confidence. And of course, that's what you got from Arnold Palmer all the time.
You know, Dick, it's funny that you mentioned that because I read a story just this week, actually, about some of your time during the Ford training program. And speaking of the auto industry and being in San Francisco, and I believe there was an opportunity that you were able to meet Eddie Lowry out there, who, of course, is the famous caddy of Francis We Met. And during that time, it almost didn't happen, but you were able to meet Eddie Lowry out there.
I was out in San Francisco. I spent a couple of months out there at the office out there, and Eddie Lowry owned a very, very successful Ford Motor dealership. Matter of fact, guys like Ken Venturi, Harvey Ward, George Archer, they all worked for Eddie Lowry at the dealership. So, of course, I wanted to meet Mr. Lowry, and obviously I knew a lot about him because I followed golf in depth since I was a young kid, and obviously him being Francis's caddy. So I go up to the dealership, and I walk in, and I said to the woman sitting out front, "Is Mr. Lowry in?" And she looked at me and said, "Well, do you have an appointment? And he won't be back for a couple of weeks or whatever." So I said, "Well, you do me a favor. Would you go into his office and tell him that Dick Connolly, a We Met scholar from Boston, would like to say hello to him?" I just took a chance. So she went in. Next thing I know, the door opens up. He comes walking out and says, "Dick Connolly, an Irish kid, a We Met scholar from Boston, get in here." He would have given me the city of San Francisco. That's how I got to meet him, though. He was a major, major man in his own right. His friends were Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, et cetera, et cetera.
I love hearing that story, Dick. That's awesome. And you just made a comment. He made his own history. We had Mark Frost on the podcast, and Mark Frost obviously wrote The Greatest Game Ever Played, but Mark Frost also wrote The Match. And the impact that Eddie Lowry had on that story, Dick, I know is something that really jazzes you
up. Eddie Lowry orchestrated that match. That's right. When you think about the match, this is how good the amateurs were back then. You get Harvey Ward and Ken Venturi playing Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson, two of the greatest players that ever walked the face of the earth. But that's how good the amateurs were back then, because there was really not much money in the Pro Tour. And Eddie bet on Venturi and Ward against Hogan and Nelson. That's how good Eddie thought they were. They lost in the last hole.
Boy, I hope that does become a movie, because it's a movie. That's real.
Have you read The Match, Alistair?
I have not. It is on my list, however. One of the next ones
I'll
read.
Oh, yeah, you got to read that.
Yeah.
You got to read that.
Yeah, obviously Eddie Lowry became famous at the time for being the youth caddy of Francis We Met in the 1913 U.S. Open. You had a chance to caddy for Francis We Met, I believe, on a couple of occasions, which is something that not many people can say.
Back in those days when Francis was obviously long past his competitive career, he would tell us, the executive director, if you want to get one of the kids to come and caddy, they'd love to have them come and caddy for him. We'd either do it at Woodland or Charles River. I had the fortunate experience of doing it a couple of times. And again, Francis is another individual, when they talk about him, they don't do him justice by calling him a great gentleman. He was a magnificent man. And a perfect gentleman at all times, obviously one of the great players of the time. And that was a big positive of being, only a few of us got a chance to do it. But of course, any time that happened twice with me, I jumped at the opportunity. And of course, I caddied for him. I walked around the 18 holes in awe. Just a wonderful, wonderful man. And you think about it, I say this all the time, but when you think about it, a 20-year-old caddy changed the course of golf history in this country, literally. Think about it. A 20-year-old caddy changed the history of golf in this country and brought golf to the common man.
In a lot of ways, Francis We Met and what he stood for and the fun that was created in his name that helped to change your life, did that ever come up in conversations, that obviously when you caddied for him just a handful of times, that you were a WeMet scholar. It helped you go to college, something that had not happened in your family, that Francis WeMet had basically changed your life for the better and ended up setting you on a course for success.
Yeah, our scholarship fund is the only thing he lent his name to.
Right. Dick, I mean, you are so successful. You've got a great family, loyal friends. Countless people look up to you. It's very easy for people to see all the success. I mean, that you just told a couple stories where you being humble and respectful turned into a great opportunity for you. I think it'd be interesting to hear, were there any struggles in your career that you might say you're better off for going through? Maybe mistakes you made or things that you do differently that you learned from that people might be interested in hearing?
Well, since I started, we've had a number of major market corrections, and the stock market getting really beat up badly. Those are trying times. And when I first started, one of the old-time brokers said to me, Dick, you got to remember one thing. Stocks go up in pennies, but they come down in dollars. So when you get into a correction, so I would say the major corrections in the market that we've had have probably been the things that tested me the most. I've been fairly lucky in the sense that I was able to build a business and get going pretty good. But as far as the tough times with the bad markets, and of course, the one thing I learned is it's easy to call someone when things are going good, but you have to make the calls more timely and more often when things are going bad in the market. And that's something that an older broker told me to make sure. And I follow that to a fairly well. So when things were tough in the markets, I would call the clients even more than I would normally. With all the computer stuff we have now, and nothing will ever take the place of face-to-face meetings. Regardless of how much technology we have and how easy it is to communicate without getting in front of people, but nothing will ever replace face-to-face meetings. That's how I built my business.
Yeah. And is that something that you would advise of a WeMet scholar just getting ready for the real world, getting ready for graduation in terms of advising how to enter the workforce?
One of the things I would tell anybody when they first get out is, first of all, be yourself. Don't try to be something you're not. And that's something else my father taught me when I was growing up. If people expect you to be something that you're not, and you try to do that, all you're doing is deluding yourself. If they don't accept you for what you are, then you don't want to be involved with them anyway. So first of all, be yourself. Understand the importance of a work ethic. Understand the importance of your reputation. One of the things I would say to people when I was trying to get them to do business is I said, look, I can't call markets. I'll do the best I can, but I will give you great service. That's all I can promise because I can't call markets, but I will do the best I can to give you the best service that myself and my firm offers. That's pretty much all you can do. It's like when you buy a new car, probably the most important thing after you buy the car is the kind of service that you get from that dealership. Well, it's no different if you open an account, whether you're in the insurance business and the brokerage business like I was or whatever, real estate business. How you service those clients is what's going to set up your future. And then what happens from there, if you do a good job of servicing those people, they're going to bring you referrals without question. Once I got established, the bulk of my business came from referrals. And a major reason that we got the referrals is because of the way we serviced the existing clients. And it wasn't because we could call markets. They haven't made the person that could call a market because so many variables can happen. And you want to be recognized for your honesty and your work ethic. Best example I had of a work ethic was my own mother. And of course, all the great education you get, if the work ethic isn't exemplified, then they're making a big mistake. So that's kind of what I would say about young people getting started.
You get that one chance for a first impression. You have one reputation. That's all you got. So yeah. And recognize, Dick. I mean, it's nice to be recognized. And I want to make sure, you know, since the last time we talked on this podcast, there was some national recognition. This past November, you were inducted into the National Caddy Hall of Fame in Chicago by the Western Golf Association. And you were inducted along with another WeMet scholar, Peter Lynch. And the Caddy Hall of Fame, for those who don't know, it highlights the tradition, the importance of caddying. It celebrates people that have committed their lives to the game of golf through caddying or supporting caddying, who've leveraged their time as a youth caddy for a stepping stone for success. Candidly, Dick Connelly and Peter Lynch check all of those boxes in terms of giving back. And so it was great to see the two of you recognized in that special way. How special was it for you to receive that honor and share it with a close friend who you both have roots in caddying?
Let me tell you a quick story about Peter. And Peter has said this many times himself. Peter caddied at Braeburn. And the fellow that he caddied pretty regularly for was a fellow named Mr. Sullivan, who was the president of Fidelity. Okay? And obviously, Fidelity is one of the great firms in the country. Thousands and thousands of people would love to go to work for Fidelity. But there was a job opening that Peter applied for. And many, many other people applied for that same job opening. And he got the job. And he would tell you firsthand, the major reason he got the job is because Mr. Sullivan knew him. He said, I never would have got this job. He caddied for the president of Fidelity. And that's how Peter got started. And obviously, the rest is history. He went on to become, in my opinion, one of the greatest money managers in history, if not the greatest. But to be recognized in that Caddy Hall of Fame, particularly coming from the Western Golf Association, which is affiliated with the Evans Scholarship Fund, meant a big amount to me. For them to recognize two We Met scholars is incredible. Well, you were out there, Carl, and you saw it. They were great to us. They paid a great tribute to the We Met Fund. They paid a great tribute to our banquet, which to me is second to none. So it was an incredible honor for me and my family, and I still haven't got over that.
I'd encourage folks to check out caddyhalloffame.org. And Dick, you and Peter are right next to some incredible names that, as an eight-year-old kid at Woburn Country Club, I don't think you drew that up.
No, not at all. Not at all. The other thing, too, that I got the opportunity to do because of caddying, I learned to play golf. So I went on to play in a lot of junior tournaments. I was 2-year captain of my golf team at Holy Cross. I never would have learned the game of golf if I didn't start to caddy. No way.
Yeah, I've read some things that Peter Lynch has said about his time caddying, and one thing that stood out to me is that he learned what adults admire. And I thought that was a cool line from him because it really taught him sort of what is to be expected of him as a mature adult. And it goes a long way in terms of him being hired at Fidelity. And I'm sure you have similar stories of caddying starting when you were 8 years old. You start to see how businessmen, successful people in the real world conduct themselves, and you emulate that.
Exactly. And the people you caddy for, one of the things you, when you're caddying for them, you're saying to yourself, I want to be like Mr. Wilson. I may not want to be like Mr. Jones. Now, most of the people by far that you caddy for are good people, nice, nice people. But every once in a while, you're caddy for someone that doesn't conduct themselves the way they should. That's when you make a decision that I don't want to act like Mr. Jones does. But the example that I get of 99% of the time from the men I caddy for, unbelievable, unbelievable.
Yeah. And that was just sort of the start of you learning that it's important to give back. I mean, those gentlemen you caddied for were, in a sense, paying it forward to you. They were teaching you life lessons at the time. And you've taken that to heart. And over the last however many years you've been in the game of golf now, the 75th anniversary of the We Met Fund, you've continued to give back. Dick Connolly is one of the first people you learn about, and how important that you've been to the organization over the years. What keeps you so connected to giving back, both you and Anne Marie?
What's our motto, Colin? For what golf has given you, give something back to golf. I pretty much try to live by that. And I've been very, very lucky in life in general. I point out all the time that the best day I ever lived, I couldn't put my mother or father's shoes on. But they never got the chance that I got. And I got that chance because of people like them that came from the World War II generation. The book that Tom Brokaw wrote, The Greatest Generation, hands down, that's the greatest generation in the history of this country. And those are the people that I caddied for. So talk about getting a good example. My mother was one of 10. She had 9 brothers. And 7 of her brothers served in World War II at the same time. 7 brothers in World War II at the same time. The World War II generation really set this country up to be what it is. There's no question. And that's the group of people that I was able to caddy for, which was an incredible experience.
And Gary Player spoke to that before he handed you the check, Dick. He loves the United States. And Ryan Durkin was talking about his brother serving and his plan was to serve. And all that was all part of that message that night.
And when you see someone like a Nate Ingram, the banquet this year, given the struggles he goes through, are those the moments where, I mean, not that you need a reason to say this is why I do it, but when you see a 22-year-old kid get up there who's gone to URI because of the We Met Fund and who's gone through all the personal struggles he has, are those the moments where you say to yourself, this is why I've stayed involved, this is why I love being a part of the WeMet family?
There's no question. That very well could be the major reason. When I got there during the banquet, before it started, we always go out and practice what we're going to say. And Colin was standing there, or walked in with me, and we went out into the main room there, and he was up there practicing his speech. I looked at Colin, and I said, "You got to be kidding me." Meaning how good the kid was. Isn't that right, Colin?
That's right. I couldn't believe it. Yep.
Talk about self-confidence. Just incredible. But yeah, when you see these young men and women that we're helping to educate, that's the major reason you do it, because they're going to go off into the world and do something good for the country. There's no question about it. With the examples they've learned as caddies and how they appreciate getting in any financial aid that we give them, that's why we're in business. We're in business to help educate young men and women that probably couldn't have been educated without some assistance from the WeMet Fund.
Well, Dick, you certainly haven't retired from WeMet. And I know the new news, March 28th, I believe, was your last day. It was a week after the Julie Inkster banquet and officially wrapping up your business career. I know you're still keeping yourself busy making phone calls and talking to your customers, but you're getting used to that new daily schedule. I'm just trying to figure out what's the biggest difference for you in the first month or two since your last day at Morgan Stanley.
Oh, yeah. It's a major adjustment. I was in the business for over 55 years, started as a very young man and got very lucky in the business. And the business was so great to me. I never thought as a young man growing up that I would ever be involved in the investment business. No one in my family had the ability to own securities. So I certainly never thought that as a young man growing up. And when I first went to Ford Motor Company, it wasn't in the cards either. I changed careers from Ford Motor Company and got very, very lucky. Yeah, so it's a major adjustment, but it'll happen over time. And I'm going to obviously stay in close touch with the clients because they're friends of mine. All the years of covering these people as clients, they became close friends in almost every single category. So that's not going to change. You know, my son, Ryan, is now heading up the group now, and the same support staff that I had there, he has with him. So he's calling the shots now, but that's not going to stop me from staying in touch with these people I've done business with for so many years and have helped me become successful. That's the reason I became successful, because of those people. They gave me a chance. They gave me a chance. And it all started, and I say this over and over again, from the time I started as a caddy and how I learned to conduct myself and try to emulate the people that I thought were special.
And Dick, you seem to be the kind of person that didn't really need a lot of vacations just because you love what you do. But now you have the chance to step back and spend some more time with your family and maybe take some trips. So have you thought about what retirement life will look like when you finally get a chance to take some well-deserved time off and some rest?
We'll probably do some traveling. But in the same vein, because of the business I was in, if you operated at a certain level within the industry, you got a lot of chances to travel during those years if you're in a certain category in the structure of the firm. So we got to see a lot of places, my wife and I, many countries, many different cities and towns. So we'll do more of that as well. And we have a house in Marion, Mass, on to Catansett for years. And Marion is one of my favorite places anywhere. So both my wife and I agree that there's no need to go anywhere in the summer if you're already in Marion. So we'll spend a lot of time there. But looking into the future, we'll definitely do some traveling. One of the places we both want to see is Normandy, which obviously has a great amount of history associated with this country, what happened over there. I haven't been there, and I know it's a very special place. So we'll do stuff like that. And, of course, we have 5 grandchildren now and maybe more to come, so that's going to take up a lot of the time as well. My son Ryan has 3, and he lives in Wellesley, so we see his kids all the time. And Richard, the oldest, lives in Connecticut. He has 2. We don't see them as often. And Kevin, the youngest, who just got married, lives in Concord. So we'll spend an awful lot of time with the grandchildren as well.
Any of the grandkids aspiring golfers yet? PGA Tour pros in the future?
Yeah, can't tell yet, Alistair, but hopefully something will happen.
Are they going to start caddying when they're 8 years old, like you did?
Well, I'll certainly recommend it. Of course, back then, when I started, I could only lug 1 bag, and half the time I was carrying it along the ground. And many of the people that I caddied for would actually carry the bag themselves for a few holes to give me a break. But that all started because of my mother's brothers and who were involved in golf. And I've probably said this before, too. There were 9 brothers, and 7 of them had handicaps
of five or less, legitimate hand, and they learn the game as caddies. I never had a lesson in my life. I learned the game from watching the good players, emulating the good players. I've said to this day, I can watch someone swing a golf club and pretty much know if they caddied or not. Because all we did was copy the good players. That gave me the opportunity to play golf. Of course, my Uncle Ernie was one of the finest amateurs in the history of New England golf, and that's made me want to become a good player. And as a youngster, I wanted to be a golf pro. But once I found out that I wasn't going to be Arnold Palmer, I knew I had to get a real job. But as a youngster growing up, that's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be Arnold Palmer. Like a lot of people wanted to be the great baseball player, the great football player. Those are the examples that you like. That's why I'm so pleased about this Scheffler kid, that the example that he presents is wonderful. It's wonderful.
Dick, was there anything on your end that you had hoped that we could cover or you wanted to expand on or something that you missed earlier?
Our most recent banquet, I thought that Julie Inkster did a great job, and I thought it was amazing that Judy Rankin, who did the fireside chat with Julie Inkster, both of these women are in the LPGA Hall of Fame. Now, the LPGA Hall of Fame is considered to be the toughest, because of their criteria, the toughest Hall of Fame to become members of. And here we had two women at our banquet, both in the LPGA Hall of Fame. And I thought they did a remarkable job. Remarkable. I think that just shows even we continue to do great things for the fund. And I think the people who were in attendance at that banquet really enjoyed it. It was great to watch. And I know this because Charlie Meacham, who was the commissioner of the LPGA for a number of years, is a close friend. And Charlie was our MC for several times himself. But after the banquet, both Judy Rankin and Julie Inkster called Charlie Meacham and raved about what a great banquet it was. When they walked in that room and saw almost 1,500 people and the reception that they got as being they're representing the We Met Fund, they couldn't believe it. And we have to keep in mind, this is the single largest golf dinner in America. We ought to be very proud of that. And a big part of it is because we have our banquet named after one of the most important people in golf history, Francis We Met.
Well, that's great to hear. And coming from Charlie, that's tremendous. I'm glad he passed that on. Well, Dick, thank you again for your time. Congratulations on the retirement. And another huge thank you to you and Anne-Marie for all you continue to do and continuing the legacy of Francis We Met, which is the fund. And it's great hearing more Arnold Palmer stories. And this was fun. Once again, thank you.